Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams Podcast. Joining me today, again, a returning guest and a dear friend of mine, Peter Atwater. Peter Atwater is someone whose work I have relied on very, very strongly over the years. He's such an incredible resource in terms of helping to try and understand the mood of the crowd, what that might mean for markets and turning points. And he's also the author of The Confidence Map, a book which he published beginning of the summer. I read the book. It is absolutely tremendous. And I'm delighted that we actually waited for the kind of book tour to die down to give, hopefully, the book another shot in the arm to put it back on people's radars, because it really is a phenomenal read. And I wanted to talk to Peter about the book, about the framework he uses, in the hope that it will give people a sense of what The Confidence Map is all about. And then hopefully we'll get a chance to chat about the world around us and see some practical applications of Peter's framework. But again, the book, The Confidence Map, if you haven't read it, I cannot recommend it highly enough. And not just because Peter's a dear friend, but because it is an absolutely exceptional read. So with that being said, why don't we just get into my conversation with Peter Atwater. Peter, my friend, welcome back to the podcast. So very good to see you again after, must be about a year, I guess, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, it's been a while, Grant, but always great to see you.
And obviously, you've just been sitting on your butt for that year, not really up to much, just kind of kicking back and enjoying life, I see.
Yeah, doing the crossword puzzle, the Wordle, yeah. You know, you're doing nothing.
Yeah, there you go. Well, listen, a few months ago, you released your book, The Confidence Map, and I'm so glad we've had a chance to do this interview a couple of months later, because, you know, I saw a lot of people talking about it at the time, which is great. And it's such a fantastic book. First of all, congratulations. It's a terrific book. I mean, you know, you and I are good friends, and you know, I'm sure I would be inclined to be receptive towards it anyway, but it really is a terrific, terrific read. And even though you and I have spoken a lot about what's in it over the years, you did such a fabulous job of explaining this to people in a way that I think gives them a framework that they can use this in their lives. And what an incredible gift it is to be able to think like this. So first of all, congratulations on that. Heartfelt congratulations.
Thank you.
And what I thought we'd do, I want to talk to you a little bit about the experience of writing the book and publishing the book and everything that goes with it. Then we'll dig into the framework that you talk about to help people understand how to use it. And then perhaps we can, you and I, game the current world we live in and try and apply a little bit of theory to practice and work out what the hell's going on in the world.
That sounds great.
So let's talk about the process of writing it. What was it that moved you to actually write this? Has it been a long time in the process? How did that all become about?
So I teach a class on confidence and decision-making, and we tend to talk a lot about group decision-making. So we'll look at political choices. We'll look at food choices. A lot of things in culture. And I thought I was teaching a class focused on group decision making. And what I realized that my students were taking away from the class a lot of important things about personal decision making and the connection of feelings. And I think the turning point for me was the morning a student came in and she had a fight with her roommate. She'd overslept. She was stressed out about a test. But she was beaming because she said, you know, Professor, I'm in the lower left-hand corner, which I'll explain later. But she understood why she was anxious, why she was struggling, but wasn't afraid of it. And I thought, wow, if she's not afraid of it, how can I get others to see not having confidence, feeling uncertain, feeling out of control? These are normal parts of life. And that's what began the journey. But I have to tell you, when I worked with a coach, a writing coach, and then we submitted the book proposal, I said, look, I have a box of Christmas tree ornaments without a tree. I have 30, 50 little insights, stories to share, but I don't know how to organize them. And my publisher said, just start writing. You know, we can move them around, but until you put stuff on paper, it's very ambiguous. And to look at the book today, you would say, of course, that's how we organized it. But I can tell you there are three different versions with three different titles that we had to work through to get there. To me, it's a real value of having a fabulous editor like Noor Schwartzberg, who I did.
Well, it's funny, as I read the book earlier this summer, I was going through it, and I did exactly that. I took what you were learning, and I was looking at these maps, and I'll include the kind of maps in the transcript so people can get a visual sense of what we're talking about, because I think that's really important. But I found myself absolutely relating to periods in my life. And as I said, you know, the really eye-opening thing for me is, as much as you and I have spoken about this over the years, and as much as I've been fascinated by the importance of confidence in this group decision-making thing, I hadn't really thought about it from that perspective until I saw the book and until I was on my own reading about confidence, not confidence in Elon Musk or confidence in stocks or confidence in bonds, but just the idea of confidence. And it does become incredibly personal, incredibly quickly.
And it's one of those terms that we so overuse without understanding what is it really. And I think culturally today, we have what I call confidence theater, where if I appear to be Elon Musk or LeBron James or Beyonce or Taylor Swift, then I must be confident. And it's like, no. This is a charade. This is an act that people put on. And you see executives do it. And if you can step back and say, no, what I need to feel confident isn't that, then you can start to make progress and understand your behavior, others' behavior, and see why we do what we do. And I think the other thing about writing this book, Grant, was there's so many books on how to improve what you do. My goal in this one was, let's just define what we do naturally. Because if you're going to get better, you better understand what your baseline is. And I think this book is all about the baseline of how changes in how we feel impact us in so many ways we don't appreciate.
Well, it's so funny. I've always, when I've thought about greed and fear from a market perspective, and everyone I think understands that greed and fear are just innate to people and therefore markets and decision making, you know, I've always thought of it through the lens that the reason that the drops are so much more chaotic and scary and violent than the rises, generally speaking, is that, you know, not everybody gets greedy, but everybody gets afraid. And so when fear takes over, it's a much stronger impulse, much stronger emotion. And, you know, reading the book, in the first chapter, I was reading this thinking, this is exactly what I've been thinking about. But confidence is to me, the thread that ties greed and fear together, you know, and when I saw that, you don't need to think about greed and fear. You can just think about it in terms of this one thing. Am I confident? And it takes care of all the rest.
And I think the other piece of it is to remember that the opposite of confidence is vulnerability. And when you start to think about behavior, particularly crowd behavior, when people feel vulnerable, then that element of impulsiveness and emotion quickly makes sense. You know, we say people don't have confidence. It's like, well, that doesn't explain the wild things that we do at lows in confidence. When I flip it and say, this crowd felt intensely vulnerable. Well, now I can explain the Arab Spring. I can explain the pandemic panic. Those moments then all of a sudden make such intuitive sense.
We'll come on to all this in a second, but I want to stick on the process of the book first. And once you've put the book together, once you're happy with it and you publish it, what's the next piece like? Because I'm sure that there's that nervousness, there's that confidence, there's that, it's all kind of wrapped up in there. What happened after you published the book?
So, you know, you spend that launch week talking to anyone and everyone. You know, the morning I did it, I think I did 15 little radio hits. And so you're talking the book, but you realize that people have to read the book.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what you're really hoping for is people read the book and say to their friends, you need to read this too. And, you know, they pass it to a coworker or a spouse or a, you know, I had somebody who said they gave it to their kid because something was going on. And so the challenge in the book world is creating a flywheel. When you're not Michael Lewis or somebody who has a track record of books, the challenge is, how do I create a groundswell, sort of grassroots interest in the book? And there are all sorts of theories about, well, you know, you got to get it in the right hands, you know, make sure Oprah sees it, or, you know, give it to this influencer, that influencer. And I don't think this is that kind of book. I think this is a book that is going to be something that people read it and share it because it unlocks something to them personally. I'm an economist or a markets person, a finance person, and I wrote it with that audience in mind. But what has been so refreshing is the interest in from the wellness world. You know, the week my book came out, there were articles about it in Psychology Today and in Forbes, which you don't normally think about. And that has been really rewarding, that people read the book and see something in their own lives that they didn't appreciate before.
That makes perfect sense to me. And it is such a personal thing, you know, this idea of confidence, because as you said, right, everyone's trying to display this air of confidence even when they're not. And I think that's certainly what, for me, made it personal. You know, every time I go on stage to give a speech, you get up there and you kind of smile and tell a joke, and inside you go, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, every single time. And I've been doing it for years. But this idea that confidence is something that we need to project rather than we ought to project or we'd like to project is just such a deeply personal thing, I think.
And we send this message that in order to be successful, you must be confident. They may have to put it on my tombstone, but to me, success comes from what you do when you don't have confidence. That confidence is a consequence of success. And so you begin to realize that it's about gaining confidence that is what creates success. How do you do this better? How do you do this? Whatever it is that you're working on, the confidence will come with repetition and practice and rehearsal, and that it's about improving that brings that reward of confidence. You know, financially it looks like success, but it's really the reward is feelings of certainty and control in your life.
Well, you know, you use a great example in the book, the Johnson & Johnson example, when you talk about vulnerability being the key to success. Just walk people through that, because that it was such an object lesson in that idea.
We think about crises as the disaster. So whether it's the deep water well explosion, an earthquake, an event, and if I look at the way we handle them, we focus on curing the problem. And I did a presentation yesterday to a group of hospital administrators talking about the concepts of the book to them. And I said, curing isn't enough. Solving the problem, ending the disease, isn't the issue. It's the feelings that come from that. And ultimately, in order to end a crisis, you have to end those feelings of vulnerability. And as I said to the doctors, it's the difference between curing and healing. And once you realize that your job is to heal a crisis, not to fix it, it changes your approach completely. And I talk in the book about Boeing. Boeing completely missed that their job was to heal, to eliminate the vulnerability after the 737 MAX crashes. They're like, no, we have a plane problem. It's like, no, you have a psychology problem.
Yep. But also, the, you know, as I said, that the one that I love was the Johnson & Johnson example, because it's so relatable. That thing is so relatable because it's around Tylenol, which is something everybody takes in one form or another.
Yeah. And they made the decision, get them all off the shelves. We're going to eliminate all vulnerability. And in many ways, you saw that impact on 9/11, land all the planes. You know, if you had kept two planes in the air, nobody would have breathed until those two planes landed. So this mindset of create a floor to the vulnerability, how do you eliminate those feelings fastest? Because that then gives you a lot of breathing ground to then fix the problem.
So true. Well, let's talk, I mean, we've kind of alluded to various parts of this. So let's talk a little bit about the confidence map and the framework and the quadrants and how that looks for people. And as I said, I'll include some images in the transcript so people can get a visual representation of this, which I think is so important in understanding it. But just take it away. Just walk us through that framework, because it's wonderful.
Yeah, so I had to go through the confidence is like pornography. We know it when we see it moment. And to define what do we really mean when we say that we're confident. There's probably yellow pads of individual words that I wrote down, and I started to cluster them and finally concluded that there were two critical elements that we need to feel confident. One is a sense of certainty, that the road ahead is predictable to us, that what we imagine is going to be something that is in some way familiar. And the other is that we have an element of control and that we feel prepared, trained, we've rehearsed, we're skillful in that future that we imagine. Those two, when they come together, is what confidence is about. I created this 2x2 matrix of certainty on the x-axis and control on the y-axis. And I said, okay, when we have high certainty and high control, that's the comfort zone. When I talk to athletes, talk to actors, you talk to anybody who is in that moment where time is flying and it's effortless, that's the comfort zone. And I love that psychologists often associate the term fluent to it. And that, as somebody who lived abroad and struggled with a second language, just makes such sense to me that, yeah, when I'm confident, things are very fluent. It's just effortless. We love that. We aspire to that. But that isn't life. Those are moments in life, but there's a lot of other moments. The opposite environment is what I call the stress center, where certainty and control are low. It's the lack of certainty and the lack of control that foster those feelings of anxiety. Why? Because we feel vulnerable. And so that vulnerability changes all sorts of things for us. It reduces my time preference, my social preference, my physical preferences. I talk about being in me here now mode when we're in the stress center. The only thing that matters is me, not you. And so you can start to see that impact on behavior. The other thing that I would say about the stress center is that lower left-hand corner where we have no certainty and no control, that defines every traumatic event in our lives. You know, psychologists and doctors, they have a whole different definition of trauma. What I have discovered is trauma always ends up in that lower left-hand corner, no matter the reason. And so the comfort zone and the stress center are the two boxes that we think about when we think of confidence, but there are two other boxes. The lower right-hand corner is what I call the passenger seat, where we have certainty but no control. And if you've had to teach your kids to drive, you realize that the environment can go from feeling very comfortable to being terrifying in a split second. So there's a real fragility to it. It's also the environments of prisons. You know, prisons are the ultimate certainty but no control environment. But we spend a lot of time in the passenger seat. And they sometimes feel good and they sometimes feel like hell. The final box I call the launch pad, where we have control but no certainty. Think about a rock climber about halfway up a mountainside. They don't know whether they're going to plummet to their death in the stress center or make it back. But we feel that if we have control, we can determine and drive the outcome. And you really saw this during COVID. If you go back and look at the decision-making from March 2020, it was all about folks taking control in an environment of intense uncertainty. What we forget in the investment world is that's where all our decisions are made. Borrowing, lending, investing, they're all made in a moment where we have control but no certainty. And so we spend a lot of time making up stories about how that investment or loan is going to end in justifying us in making that decision in the first place.
Yeah, it's funny. The thought that struck me, particularly when you talked about these bigger events and COVID, you spent a lot of time talking about COVID in the book because it was such a perfect case study for you at the right time in terms of this whole thing. But, you know, you realize that in a dynamic like that, which is a mass dynamic, one group has to have confidence and the other group has to be in the stress center, right? You've got to have someone in the who has the control, and there are a whole bunch of people that feel like they're powerless. You need someone to step in and say, okay, we have control. We may make some dumb decisions, but it was fascinating to watch how quickly and how easily people ceded control to someone coming in displaying confidence, whether misplaced or not.
Yeah, I talk about following as one of our natural, what I call the 5F responses when we're in the stress center. Fight and flight get a lot of attention. There's freeze, follow, and fuck it. And we forget with follow, it's the easiest response we have. I don't need to be skilled. I don't need to be powerful. All I need to do is get in line. And what we forget is that in those moments of intense vulnerability, we are terrible at picking those we follow. And that's why you'll see that environments of low certainty and control are the breeding ground for predators, authoritarian leaders, cult figures, all sorts of con men, grifters. We're so ripe for following. When the pipe bursts, we don't ask the plumber for qualification. We're just like, can you get here now? And so we need to be much, much more careful about who we choose to follow. Because to your point, we are so tempted to follow those who are like, I know absolutely the way from here.
The Ben Hunt pointing thing, right? Someone points at you. Yeah.
And we're terrible at that. We're seeing a lot of that all over the place right now.
Yeah. And the other thing that, you know, struck me was that we as individuals, as the collective, are vulnerable to exactly those same sorts of things, dynamics, and people at the other extreme. When we're in the confidence zone, we suffer the same problems, right?
Yeah, because when confidence is high, scrutiny is low. We're very prone, particularly to con men. I mean, you look at Elizabeth Holmes at Theranos. She took money from the extraordinarily rich, like there was no tomorrow. Yeah, you suggest the same thing with Sam Bankman-Fried. The ability to take money from people blindly at the top is remarkable. And there are other names that I could add to the list.
Well, and I suspect there'll be plenty more. That list is going to get longer, not shorter, in the coming months and years, I suspect. So let's talk about this on a personal level and talk a little bit about, once people understand this, they get this idea of there being the launch pad, the passenger seat, and then this almost train track between the stress center and the comfort zone. Talk a little bit about how people can recognize where they are and how they can actually take ownership of that and not react, but understand, because I'm here, this is what's happening. This is why I'm thinking the way I'm thinking. And this is how I can actually do something constructive rather than just react to the quadrant I'm in.
Yeah. What's remarkable to me, Grant, is how quickly people can put a pin on that map and say, I'm here.
At any point.
At any point. And I often will do it retrospectively with my college freshman. I was like, map your senior year of high school. And it's pin here, pin here, pin here. I mean, they so associate all of those moments of applying and waiting and test taking and prom. They bring up these incredibly natural feelings of certainty and control in those moments. And so you can do the same thing. And I will often do it in the morning, thinking about, where is the crowd today? Where is the crowd on the box? And you don't have to be precise, you know, just generally speaking. And even in our own lives, to say, okay, I'm in the stress center today. And I'm in the stress center today because my house is for sale and I can't sell it. I've got a pet that's sick. I've got, you know, all of these things stacking up. And just to be able to go, oh, that's where I am. Well, now I'm not so scared about where I am, because I can locate it and I know a couple of things immediately. First, my mean voice is going to come out. I am going to say terrible things about myself and about others. So this catastrophizing mindset takes over and it's like, oh yeah, I'm not my best self here. I'm also going to be incredibly impatient. And so in that moment, what we need to do is to say, how can I take more control right now? What can I do to feel more certain? And those are both actionable. I've worked with coaches, and when a player comes off the field after a bad play, and that you start to ask, what do you need to do to feel in more control? Well, suddenly this list comes up of very specific things. And we're not talking about, you know, mastering it at once, but small steps that you can do to feel more in control. And so they're very actionable and they're not always intuitive. You know, one of the examples I used in the book is volunteering. Volunteering seems so counterintuitive if you're stressed out. It's like, no, the benefit of volunteering is not only service for others and with others, but you're demonstrating that, yes, in fact, you have certainty and control in elements of your life that you've forgotten. And look at the gratitude and appreciation others give you. So we need to realize that in those moments, yes, it's bad, it's, you know, we're catastrophizing, but we need to be careful to remember that the stories we are telling ourselves in the stress center are not accurate predictions of the future as much as they are incredible mirrors of how we feel. If I'm in the stress center, I know my outlook on life sucks. And so to just be able to go, oh, that's not likely to play out. And we associate very high probabilities to very low probability outcomes.
Yes.
And we forget yeah. expected value.
Yeah, it's so true. And of course, you know, when you think of it in those terms, the other piece of the puzzle, which again, I think in one of the early chapters of the book, you had a great example of this, and that's the fact that we can sit there and work out where we are in the quadrants within a given situation. But of course, everyone else in that situation feels very different. You know, and I think, I forget, it was an early chapter, but you gave this example of a flight you took, I think from New York to LA, and how you felt when there was an aborted landing. And it really struck me when I looked at the confidence maps of you and the pilot. It was such a fantastic illustration. So just walk us through that story. A, it's a great story, but B, the example that I thought it set, again, really helped me think about this in a different way.
Yeah, so you know, we've all been on planes, and I was on a plane that had an aborted landing, and so I immediately associated an aborted landing with the lower left-hand corner. I felt powerless, things felt intensely uncertain. And I talk a little bit about if you were a nervous passenger before you got on the plane, that intensity, that's now a traumatic event. You were even further in the lower left-hand corner than I was. Somebody who's experienced it before, a frequent flyer, may have not been fazed by it. It's like, oh yeah, that doesn't bother me. But as I was writing the book, it struck me. I said, you know, I've never asked a pilot. And I have friends who are pilots. So I reached out to a friend, and he was at JFK between flights. And so it was fun to catch him in the moment. And I said, so what map would you create? And he sent me a picture of his map that he drew on a napkin. And it's obvious that for a pilot, it's not a big deal. And he said, you know, first of all, Peter, we don't call them aborted landings. It's called a go-around. And just that term suddenly changes your perspective. It's like, of course it's a go-around. Of course this is something you prepare for, you train for, you talk about, you rehearse. And so, you know, he jokes, it's like, it's called Tuesday. This is what we do. And when you realize that for the pilots, this is nothing out of the ordinary, you should really feel better about that. And in the moment, we obviously don't, but you realize that preparation and skill, and again, the element of control, they do control the plane at that point, changes how you feel.
You know, when I read that story, it's funny, it took me back. And when you talk about this idea of a go around being a much more benign way to think about it, I mean, as soon as you think about it in those terms, it does change your perspective. I was on a flight taking off in Malaysia, I was flying out of KL at like midnight on my way to London one time, maybe 15 years ago. And as we took off, the wheels had just left the tarmac and one of the engines blew on this. It was a 747. So we're taking off. You can hear the whine of the engines and suddenly there's this bang and one of the engines is on fire. There's flames out the side of the plane. And talk about no certainty and no control. I mean, you're in the stress center there. Two things are interesting. One, the plane got deathly quiet. There was no screaming, which you would, in a movie, it would be screaming, right? You realize you live in a movie, everyone was screaming. The opposite happened. Everyone got complete, you could hear a pin drop on that plane. And then once they kind of got it under control, and we had maybe, I mean, it felt like 15 minutes of flames out the back. It was probably no more than two while they got the extinguisher and stuff. But I was taken back to the moment the pilot came on the tannoy for the first time after the event. We'd all seen the event, right? We'd all seen what happened. You could, even if you're on the other side of the plane, it was midnight. So all you could see out the left side were flames, bright orange sky. And the pilot came on the tannoy. He was a Malaysian guy, but obviously speaking English, because all pilots do. And he said this, which to this day bewilders me. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the explosion you heard was us losing one of the engines." And I thought instantly at the time, I thought, why would you choose that word? Like, it's such an evocative word, like the noise you heard or the, you know, the turbulence you felt, something. But talk about choosing the right word, the go around. It was the complete opposite of that. And it had on me personally that effect. It suddenly, oh my God, it was an explosion. It wasn't a noise. It wasn't, I knew what it was, but having someone in control and with certainty explain it in those terms completely changed my outlook on it.
Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time looking at the words people use, because those words sometimes get used by mistake, but often they are great indicators of how people feel. And it may be, in this case, an issue of just what's the easiest word to translate. You know, if English is not your native language, you're trying it in a simple way, and it may be that that was the word that came to mind fastest. But other times it's, whoa, that's an interesting choice. And so what's that telling us about how people really feel?
So let's talk a little about using the map within the context of why we're here, to talk about finance and investing. Using the confidence map to decipher the headlines. And, you know, you and I, whenever we've spoken in the past, and whenever I check your Twitter account, which I do every day, there is always, I mean, every single day, there are these things that you point out, and they're nearly always turning points. They're nearly always, you're showing examples of being way too high in that comfort zone, way too top right, and way too deep in the stress zone, bottom left. Talk a little bit about how you use those two extremes, bottom left, top right, to decipher the headlines and recognize turning points.
The first thing to remember is that the media mirrors our mood. They don't change how we feel as much as reflect how we feel. So I'm always looking at headlines to say, what do these banners say about us, the reader, the crowd, because they're incredibly precise in expressing sentiment. And when confidence starts to approach either extreme, the headlines become even more extreme along with it. And they're extreme in a couple of ways. They're reporting trends that have gone on relentlessly. There's no end in sight. You start to see the extrapolation of a trend into the future in a very powerful, forceful, unstoppable way. Unstoppable is, it's unstoppable. It's going to get worse or can only get better. And so those headlines are cluing us in that we're rapidly approaching an extreme. They're also reporting extreme behavior. So if you go back to early 2021, we're talking about overflowing SPAC IPOs and zero-day options. And so you can start to see that what is newsworthy is extreme behavior all on its own. And so, again, it's giving us clues. And what I'm looking for in those headlines is a feeling of impulsivity and high emotion, because those are really what accompany both extremes in sentiment. At peaks, there's also sort of this futuristic fantasy. So not surprisingly, in early 2021, you had things like Lordstown Motors and all of the untried and untrue companies who were coming to market because, again, the crowd wants this, has this insatiable demand. That's those other terms that I look for. And what I would say is, at the extremes, not all the tiles are going to be black or white, but it's the mosaic. Have substantially all of the tiles turned here? Because you're not trying to time the markets to the moment, but to basically say, yeah, we are rapidly approaching the extreme. And rather than being seduced by it and getting caught up in the emotion, to look at the extreme as an objective condition and to say, yep, we're getting close. And we make our worst decisions at those extremes because we are so emotional and so impulsive. We capitulate all in or capitulate all out. And if you can just avoid acting at the extremes in ways that are self-destructive, over the long term, you have an enormous benefit relative to others.
I think just the very fact that through this framework of yours, rather than being someone who reacts to the mood, you're actually looking for those extremes. And I find once you're looking for them, as you say, it doesn't mean you're at the turning point, but you know the conditions are getting so much riper for a turn to one of those other quadrants again. And I have found it a really useful way to step out of being in the middle of it and be able to look at the world. This idea of spotting these turning points that you've come up with and Ben Hunt's Why Am I Reading This Now? Those two ideas have been so helpful to me in being able to remove myself from being dragged along with the crowd for different reasons in both directions.
And you can test it in some ways by saying, if I were to act right now in the opposite direction of the crowd, would it be laughable? Would my boss kick me out of the office if I walked in and said, I really think we ought to buy or we really ought to sell this right now? Because those responses are, again, indications of where the crowd is. And being contrarian in those moments likely brings up those worst moments of middle school where you are so out of sync with everybody else.
So why is it that we as a collective get it so wrong 100% of the time in both directions? What is it about us as a species that manages to find a way to be at our most delusional, either at the very top or the very bottom?
Well, I think at the bottom, it's because we're encoded to eliminate vulnerability. And I would say we abhor vulnerability more than we crave confidence. It's why losses feel worse than gains feel good. And so we are encoded to eliminate vulnerability. And in the markets, that means get out. And so we will resist that until all hope is lost. And when hope is lost, that's the moment that we collectively all run for the exits. And it's those moments where I always say to my students, panic is God's way of telling us the worst is behind us. And that we think it's ahead of us. But if you can just step back, and I use panic as a very clear objective state. When I see panic, I know that the crowd is rapidly approaching a low in confidence, no matter what the behavior is. And so just to be able to look at panic and realize, oh, that's something that only happens in these situations. It allows you to just say, yeah, we're getting close. And, you know, in the middle of March 2020, I did a webinar for the business school at William & Mary. It's like, look, this is a great sign that we are nearing the lows. Don't get swept up in it.
And what is it that turns that? Is it simply the fact that we extrapolate things are only going to get worse, 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 and way worse? And then as soon as they don't, they objectively don't get worse, we all suddenly breathe a sigh of relief. What is it that makes those turns happen?
There's no sigh of relief. There's exhaustion. What marks the low is that everyone feels powerless and has acted on it. And so once that action exhausts, that's the low from which confidence then builds. And if you were to look at 2008, the collapse of Lehman Brothers marked the low in sentiment. And the failure of Lehman Brothers caused confidence to rise doesn't make any sense. Just doesn't feel comfortable at all. But if you wanted to look at causation, and you know, you could create really bad causation and saying collapse was here, confidence was low, confidence rose, therefore the failure of Lehman Brothers made us feel better. That's not true. What it says is Lehman Brothers was that exhaustive moment. And once that passed, confidence slowly began to rebuild. And in the markets, you get the V because once the selling exhausts, you've just eliminated this huge dynamic of imbalance.
Yeah. And of course, the Lehman panic of 2008 was another moment where we in the financial industry ceded control and confidence to the Henry Paulsons of the world, the Ben Bernankes of the world, who, even if whether we believe them or not, came out and said, it's going to be okay. We're going to do the tarp. We're going to do all these things and we will fix it. And we happily went, okay, great. It's going to be okay.
And here I'm going to annoy some folks, but I would say policymaker behavior is a lagging indicator. They respond to how we feel. They're not going to act until we are despondent. And we saw it in 2008. We saw it in March of 2020. And so it's not that they necessarily made us feel better, but they were accompanying our rise in confidence. And so I will often look at intervention as a very consistent lagging indicator. The Fed doesn't lead us as much as it's following us. If you can identify a bureaucratic government body that requires consensus, that moves faster than the crowd, you know, my hat is off to you. But the reality is the markets will always move faster than policymakers.
Well, that brings us on to markets. So let's talk about markets. With all that as a kind of background and as a framework, let's talk about markets. Because again, you know, we're in what I would imagine is some pretty rich fishing waters for you in terms of looking for headlines and looking for those words, those emotive words. There's a whole bunch of different places that I'd love to get some thoughts on. But let's start with the bond market, because it's something where there's some real turbulence for the first time in a long, long time. And I am starting to see the kind of words that you look for. So help us understand what you think's going on in the bond market and where we are in that kind of stress center to comfort zone move.
Yeah, so I think importantly, we need to remember that peak in the bond market was expressed by trillions of dollars in negative yielding bonds, Austria issuing a 100-year bond. But what you saw was extraordinary overconfidence. You know, to buy a negative yielding bond, you have to believe that yields are only going to become even more negative. So the presence of negative yielding bonds in mass should have told people this ride is coming to an end, and obviously didn't. And so now what we're having is this unwind of intense overconfidence. And what's so striking to me about this unwind is you've got long bonds off 50% in value, and it's a yawn. As somebody who looks for emotion, I'm seeing, yes, it's a relentless sell-off. Okay, that's helpful. But then I see somebody referring to, you know, rising interest rates as a shock collar. And I'm thinking, we're nowhere near an extreme. And I sort of feel like we're boiling frogs. And by analogy, I would say we saw this frog boiling experience with COVID. COVID was contained, then it wasn't contained, but it was in China, then it may be in Europe. But it took somebody to jump out of the water, Tom Hanks and Rudy Gobert. You know, that night, suddenly two very insignificant things happened that the crowd jumped out of the water. And I think we await that moment. It still doesn't feel like there's enough emotion to the sell-off for it to end. And moreover, I mean, people are piling into, you know, the long ETF like there's no tomorrow. I was writing something yesterday that, you know, I haven't seen this much knife buying since Boy Scout camp. Everybody is going to the Trading Post and they just want, you know, that sense that it's got to turn up now. It's like, that's not what defines lows. True lows in confidence, you're an idiot. To buy is laughable.
Well, it's funny you use that word contained. And again, you know, in the book, you talked about the use of this word contained, that COVID, they literally used that word. We're going to contain this. And obviously Bernanke used it in early 08 or late 07, probably talking about the housing market being contained. You know, it's again, these words that are designed to foster one reaction in the crowd, generally speaking, are huge signs that we're in the completely opposite place where you think we are.
Yeah, and contained is one of those that's binary. It's either contained or it's not. And I feel sometimes policymakers set themselves up when they use words like that, because it's going to be an all or nothing bet. The extraordinary power of organizations, you realize that sort of like a prison guard system, there's either complete potency or none. I think you run the risk of these sorts of prison riot events.
So if we're nowhere near capitulation in the bond market now, and I get this sense. Let's extrapolate that one step further into Jay Powell, because obviously we're recording this on Friday, the 20th of October. He had a press conference yesterday that was upstaged by some people running in. So two questions. One, what does that say? The fact that these guys decided it was time to go and disrupt and invade the New York Luncheon Club, whatever the place was he was at. And two, where is Jay Powell in this, given the state of public emotion and their position on the quadrant, and that the position on the quadrant of central bank governors, who obviously have a very different mandate here in terms of what they need to kind of engineer as an outcome?
Well, I think you have this collective belief, both on the part of investors and on part of central bankers themselves, that they can control yields. Certainly, the Bank of Japan has demonstrated that. And the challenge is that what controls yields isn't central banks, but is the belief in central banks. So, you know, what keeps a prison calm isn't the overwhelming force of the guards, but the belief of the overwhelming force. And so the danger here is that omnipotence is now challenged. And again, that's a binary moment. And when you talk about bond vigilantes, what you're really talking about is challenging that omnipotence. So it becomes a lot of jawboning, a lot of, you know, back and forth speech making. But one of the things that I found, I was asked a while ago, how would you measure sentiment in central banks? And I said, it's remarkably easy to me. It's interest rates. If you go back to the early 1980s, nobody thought the Fed had any credibility, any competence, and we saw yields at 20%. People were terrified of central bank power when yields were negative. So I think that one of the risks in this narrative is, as interest rates rise, central banks are going to be scrutinized more, they're going to be doubted more. Confidence in central banks as a power organization are going to deteriorate as rates rise. And that has a potential to create a rather vicious spiral given where rates were. You know, you said a moment ago, you know, it doesn't feel like we are close to a low in bond yields. And what I would say is that's maybe true in terms of price, but it may not be true in terms of timing. So tipping points don't have to be significant. They have to be resonant. And I think the bond market is ripe for a resonant tipping point that finally creates impulsive emotional behavior.
Okay. So moving that out away from the bond market, obviously we have the situation in the Middle East, which is bubbling up and has kind of, amazingly, it seems to, at least in the public consciousness, come out of nowhere, which for people of our age is remarkable to think that conflict in the Middle East could catch anybody by surprise, because you know, we grew up with it as a constant drumbeat in the background. Talk about the various leaders here and the position they're in on the quadrant and the decisions they're being forced to make with confidence, not just in the people who voted them into power, but also the other leaders that they're having to try and deal with.
Yeah. So as you know, Grant, I have been very open about my feelings of overconfidence in the Saudi royal family.
Yes, very much so.
And you can see that demonstrated in their interest in sports and this new skyscraper high, new city, the NEOM development. And so they're displaying extraordinary overconfidence in the way they're investing. You know, that quote from last year, when they put money into Credit Suisse, you know, it's just a check. Those are words that you only say when you believe that there is a overflowing volume of funding coming behind it. Arguably, that's a similar mindset of the leaders of the UAE. You know, you just based on what you see in terms of over-the-top behavior in places like Dubai and Abu Dhabi City. So you have, on the one hand, organizations that are extraordinarily overconfident. And what we forget, if you think about those as being the establishment, there are those that then feel intensely vulnerable, who feel left behind and voiceless. The whistleblowers in a corporation come to mind when you think about folks that are sort of trampled in terms of their voice. And I think what people forgot is that there comes a point of voicelessness where you have enough and you respond. And I would argue that what we've seen in Palestine is those at the very bottom finally reaching a breaking point and doing something about it. It's not a reflection of their extreme confidence as much as their intense vulnerability. The idea that there could be this peace pact between Israel and Saudi Arabia is anathema if you're Hamas or Hezbollah. And so I think we forget sometimes that when a group is overconfident, there is a small group that is feeling intensely vulnerable. A far less potent analogy would be what we saw leading into the rise of Donald Trump. Those that were left behind in a global elite, financially driven economy, finally saying, I've had enough. Again, that voicelessness that leads to this need to regain some element of control.
With that being said, you know, when I look back at MBS shaking everybody's hand and bringing everybody together, that moment, again, it takes me back to you on the plane and the pilot on the plane, because I think we in the West were looking at that with a huge sigh of relief. You know, oh, great, peace is going to come to the Middle East. This is wonderful, rapprochement on both sides, and this, what a great thing. But obviously, at the time, none of us are thinking this is a really bad development for some people who it's going to make uncomfortable. So with that being said and understood, where does it put the leaders? Where does it put Netanyahu? Where does it put Biden? Where does it put Hamas now? Given what's happened and the dominoes that have toppled since the attacks, where does that place the various leaders who are right front? And actually, Zelensky, we can bring him into this because this is obviously going to change the world around him as well.
If I look at the G7 leaders, it is filled today with individuals who are extremely high confidence era figures, whether it's, you know, Rishi Sunak or Macron or Trudeau or Biden. You have leaders who are almost caricatures of the kinds of figures you pick at extreme highs in confidence. And so they're very vulnerable to a crowd that's looking for somebody who's aggressive, who is willing to fight, who is clearly going to attract strident followership. These are moderates, and we can argue left or right leaning, but compared to the potential extremes at either end, these folks are somewhere in the middle. Middle is a very dangerous place to be when sentiment turns. I also think if we then look at the Saudi royal family, the association of corruption and self-indulgence makes them very vulnerable internally. And so those have big geopolitical implications. You know, I think Israel is interesting in that you have this forced coalescence at a low in confidence, which is very frequently the case. You know, my enemy's enemy is my friend, so we will unite in opposition to them. But those are very fragile, particularly as things become protracted. What is clear to me is how few Zelensky-like figures we have out there today who are able to navigate crises effectively. You know, one of the things I write about in the book is crises require completely different kinds of leaders. To me, the four-season leader is a very rare beast. And I don't see a lot of crisis leaders easily identifiable today. And so I think we could see a lot of new names appear out of nowhere on a geopolitical basis, you know, in the next 12 to 24 months.
It's interesting, you know, when I'm thinking about that, I go back to, which is probably just my default, but I go back to the Premier League soccer in the UK. You know, there are a handful of managers, and anyone who's watching this who's a big Premier League fan will understand. There are guys like Sam Allardyce and Tony Pulis. There are three or four managers who, if you are in danger of getting relegated from the Premier League and you've got 10 games left, you fire your manager and you bring one of these guys in. You bring them in. They're a crisis manager. The football is going to be awful to watch, but they've had a lot of success in taking crappy teams and saving them from disaster and then leaving the next season, because nobody wants to watch that all the time. Nobody wants to watch him play that kind of football, but just keep us in the game and then we'll get ready and we'll call you again in a couple of years if we need you. You know, we don't have that in politics.
No, and what you have is a crowd of leaders who have been led to believe that their job was to prevent crises. And so their whole belief system is around crisis prevention, not crisis management. And when you talk to them about crisis management, they'll tell you, you know, well, we've got six different potential crises we worry about. It's like, no, that's not how it works. You know, that's like an ER department that's set up to do broken bones, but no heart attacks. You got to be prepared for them all. But at the same time, there are individuals and groups for whom crisis is Tuesday, to your point, you know, those coaches that you hire. And I think we are likely to see new leaders come to the fore for whom crisis is Tuesday. And their resilience and experience is what resonates with the crowd, because they can demonstrate, I've been at the bottom and have demonstrated how you get out. And those leaders are likely to be intensely effective if they get their messaging right.
Well, it's been very interesting for me in recent weeks to see how much reframing of the Trump presidency has been going on social media and corners of the media, and not the extreme corners of the media at all. But there's been this sense of, let's re-examine the Trump presidency through the lens of not him, but what he did and how effective he was. A lot of people have trouble kind of pulling the two apart. It's all wrapped up in him. But it's just been noticeable to me that I've seen here and there a lot more of that kind of, well, you know, Biden's going to build the wall. Maybe Trump wasn't such an idiot after all. And Trump this and Trump that. And for some, you know, Chamath, for example, came out the other day talking about Trump in positive terms. Now, Chamath is a particular kind of grifter, and I'm sure there's something behind that. But it's very interesting to see people who, a year ago, for their own public image, would never have been caught dead saying something positive about someone like Trump, even if they believed it, are suddenly happy to be seen in public talking about such a thing.
Yeah, and so I watched that, because confidence draws a crowd. We all want to be dating Taylor Swift. I think
worse.
It's interesting. You know, suddenly the NFL is all excited about being wedded to Taylor Swift, and the danger is then, as confidence wanes, the popularity of this entourage will go with it. I have a rather simplistic view of Donald Trump. This is not political. It's again sentiment driven. During 2016, he was called the Elon Musk of Washington. Musk was called the Trump of Silicon Valley. My sense is they're joined in terms of sentiment. So as one goes, will go the other. Tesla is a pretty good proxy for how folks feel in, I think, both cases.
I'm so pleased you brought that up to save me doing it, because the last thing I was going to ask you was Musk. You know, you and I have both found him such a fascinating figure for many reasons, but for what you just described, you know, he has been such a tell as to mood and confidence. You know, as his star rose, it rose right along with the public confidence. And, you know, here we are post-Twitter, and I don't know whether you think Twitter was the kind of apogee of that. I don't know, but I'm curious to get your take on where Musk is now and what his current situation and the current coverage he's getting is telling us about where we are collectively.
Yeah, so I think of Elon Musk as the Kevin Bacon of every hot trend in the post-banking crisis, EVs, solar, crypto, space. He's just in the middle of it, and deliberately so. His read of the crowd and the ability to deliver resonant ideas to a highly confident audience is extraordinary. His challenge is, ultimately, there are promises and there are deliverables. And I think his worst case scenario is that Tesla is a car company, not a future coming attraction of a car company. And so you're starting to see the bloom come off the rose. And I think that he is one of those symbols from this cycle that is likely to face a rather precipitous decline in approval as a sort of a fallen symbol that inevitably happens. In the midst of Beatlemania, no one would have imagined the breakup and the demise of the Beatles that subsequently followed. History suggests the same kind of fate exists for him. To be clear, I don't wish him ill, but when you transcend business into culture broadly, you become the beneficiary and victim of the crowd's change in taste. And so as our tastes change, it is likely that he is going to fall out of favor.
So is it a case of, in a period of extreme confidence, he dragged Tesla higher along with his confidence, along with his whole public shtick. He dragged Tesla along with him. And now, if you're right, and Tesla is, quote, just another car company, which a lot of people seem to be thinking it is, does it work in reverse that Tesla drags him down?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
I think they're conjoined. Tesla, to me, is a barometric reader of how we feel about Elon. Nobody bought Tesla stock independent of buying it under the leadership of Elon Musk.
Yeah. Okay. Very true. Well, look, Peter, we've gone way over the hour, for which I both apologize and thank you. Look, again, the book is tremendous, and hopefully this last hour and 10, hour and 12 minutes that we've been chatting will give people a sense of that. And I hope everybody goes out and buys it, not just for your own self-esteem and bank account, but for their own mental well-being, given what the world is rapidly becoming. But before we go, just give people an idea of where the best place is to buy the book. Your Twitter account is an absolute must-follow, and so let people know where they can find you.
Yes, buy the book wherever you want to buy the book, whether it's Amazon or Barnes & Noble or your independent bookstore. And it's audiobook, ebook, all those different varieties.
Now, did you read the audiobook? I read the book.
Oh,
you
I did.
How was that?
You know, it's funny. You write things on paper, never realizing that you would say them. And so there's a few alliterations that it's like, ooh, that's too clever. it was a fun experience. My wife says, tell readers not to listen to it late at night behind the wheel. You're going to put them to sleep. But that's my hometown fan base.
Yeah, there you go.
They can find me on Twitter, Peter_Atwater, on LinkedIn. I have my own website, peteratwater.com. And, you know, for folks who are interested, I do a weekly commentary, as you know, looking at the markets and what's going on in and outside of the markets, trying to make sense of how these fit together. And that's financialinsights.com.
Insights with a Y. And I'll put links to all these in the transcripts, because your work has just been fantastic. And I've followed it for many years, and never more so at potential turning points, you know, because I think you've done a tremendous job at both ends of these swings in being early and saying, look, watch out for this because things are changing, and here's why, and here's how it works, and here's what it means. So again, kudos to you, Peter, and my thanks to you for giving up your time on a Friday. And I hope we get to see each other in person fairly soon, because it's been way too long.
It has. I look forward to it.
All right, my friend. Thanks so much again.
Thanks.
Well, as I promised you, a fascinating conversation, a wonderful human being, and an incredibly enjoyable and helpful book. Again, I can't plug this enough. This is not a paid plug, I promise you. It's a wonderful book, The Confidence Map. As Peter said, both my kids are getting a copy. You'll find it at peteratwater.com. You'll be able to find places to buy the book. It's at Amazon. It's at all the places you would normally buy a book. Peter_Atwater is Peter's Twitter handle. And if you don't follow him already, I cannot, again, recommend highly enough that you do. You will find so many thought-provoking tweets from Peter on a daily basis. My thanks to Peter for joining me, and my thanks, as always, to you out there for listening. I'll be back with another episode in the not-too-distant future. Thanks again for listening. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.